today. And I'm going to fail miserably. Was not to make this about me. But TJ just said, I know more about me than anybody else. That's probably true. Because I know my weaknesses. The only person that knows my weaknesses better than me is my wife. And I have some strengths, but they don't always manifest as benefits in these circumstances. Like I can fly a plane through hell, but don't ask me to talk to air traffic control while I'm doing it, because they're secondary, you know. They're not going to be able to do anything for me. They're on the ground some thousands or hundreds of miles away. I'm dealing with the here and the now. And we're all dealing with the here and the now. And much of this parashat is about that, is dealing with the here and the now. We had a little technical difficulty and didn't have a printed copy. The reason TJ reads scripture for me is because it's a mental block from childhood. I can't see when I get nervous and I have to read aloud. I speak publicly all the time. I have to. And I'm comfortable with that. But I have to memorize everything I do. Because when I see that, when I look at this, this is an illusion for y'all. Because I can't actually see what's on this page. And so I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to read the scriptures myself because she didn't have a copy to read. And oh my goodness, here we go. And this is going to be a disaster. Even in our parashat groups on Friday, mercifully, Candy and John and Carly, Ray and others will read so that I don't have to. Even in a small setting like that, I just go blank. I can't see the page. So enough about me. The parashat for today is a Sefer Bamidbar, which is literal translation is into the desert. The desert we translate it in English as into the wilderness or into the travelings of the wilderness. And there's been a lot of ink spilled on this one parashat, the beginning of the book of Numbers. And I spend a lot of time looking at both Hebrew and Christian Jewish writings to try and prepare for this thing. And what I saw was staggeringly, well, it was horrible, actually. In Christianity, they use this section of scripture to prove the outmoded laws, you know, that the age of service was all, you know, denigrated and trivialized. The outmoded temple tax, in fact, that was vilified. The unnecessary priesthood and the uselessness of it, etc. For the Jewish people, it was even more trivial. The sages, such as Rashi, said that the reason that God took a census in the first chapter of Numbers was because he loves his people so much that he's always counting them. Really? He knows how many people there are. He doesn't sit there and sift them through his fingers. Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You know, it's just asinine. I'm so sorry. That's just ridiculous. But that's the kind of content that I was finding. Other elements that they held up as being really important was the flags that each of the tribes had to designate their location whenever they were oriented around the Mishkan. The flags, that's the important part. And then then they highlighted or elevated the importance of certain families or family groups. Well, that's the important thing. Really? Aren't we all part of Yeshua's family? God's family? I just found it all kind of shallow and trivial until I got into it. And then I found it is much deeper and more profound than I'd ever expected. So as I said before, at the Torah processional, you're going to have to hang on, because I'm not going to be able to spend a lot of time on each topic, and I'm not going to be able to develop them. About the time we get to highlight a point, we're going to be moving on to something else. And it'll be difficult. It'll seem disjointed. It does have a flow, but I'm not sure that it's actually appropriate for this. But we're gonna do it anyway. So let's just dive right in. Numbers 1:1 through 3, TJ. Mm-hmm.
The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first day of the second Chodesh, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Take a census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel by their families, by the house of their fathers, by the number of names, every male by their counted heads, from 20 years old and upward, all in Israel who are able to go to war. You and Aaron shall list them, company by company."
Okay, notice that this is the second month, first day of the second month, in the second year. They've already been in the wilderness for over a year, about 14 months. So what have they been doing for a year? Anybody know? Has anybody looked into that? I mean, that should be the first, that was the very first question that I asked, is what the heck have they been doing for a year? Well, the text offers some of the answers, and you can tease out the rest from other sources. One of the first hints is all of Israel who were able to go to war. That's in the text. All those who were able to go to war. They were documenting and training an invasion force for a year. Okay? You got to realize that the people of Israel, the children of Israel, scared the heck out of the Egyptians before the Exodus ever occurred. Part of the reason that they were scared is because opponents, other countries, would try, or under tribal groups, would try and attack Egypt, and the Israelites would be out doing their business, and the attack would come, and the Egyptians would go out to meet them. And the Israelites, who were out there herding their flocks and stuff, they'd join them. The Israelites would whoop up on the tribes, and then they'd just go back to herding their flocks. And the Egyptians saw that, and they went, "Oh, we're scared. These people are mightier and greater than we are. Their numbers are so great that if they join our enemies, they're going to overtake us." They were terrified of the Israelites because of their power and their might. And they did it out of it was just a haphazard thing that was part of who they were. They were the blessed of God. They were a terrifying foe. And they spent 60 months in the wilderness training an invasion force, at least in part. That was one of the things. 60 months. In World War II, in 1943, the boot camp to go serve in the Army was only 13 weeks. They increased it to 14 weeks. They realized they didn't need that much training. They reduced it to 6 weeks. And by 1945, boot camp was a mere 2 weeks. 60 weeks is how long they've spent training in the wilderness. This was arguably the best trained fighting force in the history of mankind. What else were they doing? They were learning to fear Adonai, and they also created the priesthood of the Levites. The Levites were exempt from military service, but does that mean that they got an easy ride? Did they get a free pass? Because they weren't on the fighting force, they weren't part of the invasion force. I would argue that their job was just as, if not more, dangerous than the fighting force was. Numbers 3, 6, and 10. 3, 5, 6, and 10.
Mm-hmm. Then the Lord said to Moses, bring the tribe of Levi and present them to Aaron the priest to assist him. And that continues in verse 10. So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons to carry out the duties of the priesthood, but any outsider who approaches the tabernacle must be put to death.
So they were defending the tabernacle. They were a fighting force of their own. And they were the security for the tabernacle. Not just because they didn't want the holy places to be profane, but they didn't want Adonai to break out against the congregation and hurt them. It was a holy place. Also, if you were doing the work inside the tabernacle and you did it wrong, what was the result? Death. Ask Aaron about that and his sons who went in to the sanctuary without permission. Even the furnishings were deadly. Numbers 4:15.
And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, as the camp sets out, after that the sons of Kohath shall come to carry these, but they must not touch the holy things, lest they die.
If they touch the furniture, they're dead men. Pretty tough stuff. These were the toughest guys probably in the tribal congregation. They actually replaced the firstborn. The firstborn of Israel were intended to be, did you know this? The firstborn of Israel were intended to be the one to minister in the tabernacle and later should have been the ones to minister in the temple. But because of the sin of the golden calf and the faithfulness of the Levites to stand with Moses at the golden calf and take out justice on those or retribution on those who would sin against God by building this idol, they now became the substitute for the firstborn to serve in the holy place, the ones who get to be the closest to God. Numbers 3:41-42.
The Levites must be reserved for me as substitutes for the firstborn sons of Israel. I am the Lord. And the Levites' livestock must be reserved for me as substitutes for the firstborn livestock of the whole nation of Israel. So Moses listed all the firstborn among the people of Israel, as the Lord commanded him, and all the firstborn males, according to the number of names, from a month old and upward, as listed were 22,273.
It's interesting to me that the Levites numbered 22,273, and the number of the firstborn were how many in this parashat? I know that probably most didn't read it previously before we got here, but how many firstborn are there in to be counted as part of the census? Anybody know? 22,000. So it's the same number. In other words, it was a direct swap. They were also being trained to be organized in a particular way, and I would say in a terrifying and militarized way. Numbers 2:1-2.
And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "The people of Israel shall camp each by his own standard with the banners of their fathers' houses. They shall camp facing the tent of meeting on every side."
So there's been some who list the significance of the layout of the camp. Some say that if you take the numbers, and you can do this, if you take the numbers of the tribes of Israel and lay them out east, north, south, east, and west around the Mishkan in a straight line, which this implies that they were one camp next to the next tribe, and so on. It forms the cross because one leg is longer, the two sides are equivalent, and the top is the shortest if you go by the number of the tribes of Israel and the way they camped. There's been some ink spilled on that, but I'm not sure as though that's all that important. It may be. I'm not sure that it's important. But this was really more of an impressive show to those who would oppose them. What do you think it looks like to the people of Canaan, to the inhabitants of Canaan, when this 2 million man force moves into their land and they camp in a specific array, perfectly organized, perfectly orchestrated, because the cities were just a hodgepodge and sprawl of the time. And here you have this finely tuned, highly organized fighting force moving into your land. What do you think those people felt like when they moved? If you had 25 abreast, 25 Israelites abreast, and you moved that many people, the length of the column is 44 miles long. This is an impressive thing. And when they stopped, it was an impressive thing. Ask Balaam when he was hired to go and curse the people of Israel. And he went up on the mountain. He looked down and he goes, oh my goodness, this is, what the heck? And he was unable to bless them, but that's a different story. Probably the most important thing that they were, that they, in this year-long period, year-plus-long period, that they achieved was that they were also taught to be obedient. They were taught the Torah. They were taught the law of Moses. Or at least we think they were taught to be obedient. But this whole effort was in preparation for these people to occupy the promised land. So what was the actual purpose of the census? Why did they take a census? Any guesses? The reason, in my opinion, and I think the text bears this out, the reason is highlighted in Numbers 1:16.
These are the chosen leaders of the community, the leaders of their ancestral tribes, the heads of the clans of Israel.
The literal translation states that these are called of the company, the princes of the tribes of the fathers. They are the heads of thousands of Israel. These are the important people. In fact, if you look up the Strong's word that is for the princes, its definition is, it's a nesai. The word means an exalted one, a king, a sheikh, or a prince. These are really important. These are selected by God to be the important people, the leaders, the heads of state within the tribe. The census recorded the generation and the leaders by name that were going to take possession of the promised land. This was going to be their coronation, their greatest achievement. This would memorialize them for their righteousness. This would memorialize them for their righteousness. Abraham believed Adonai, and it was counted to him for righteousness. They were the ones who stood to be exalted, not just now, but for all time. Their names were recorded in the Bible before they ever walked into the land. But what really happened? What happened? This part, I think you all know. Anybody remember? What happened? Only a few weeks later, they send in spies. Numbers 13, 1 and 2.
And Jehovah speaketh unto Moses, saying.
Now, this is the literal translation. So it's a little tough to follow, but I'm doing it purposefully. Go ahead and start again.
And Jehovah speaketh unto Moses, saying, send for thee men, and they spy the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the sons of Israel. One man for the tribe of his fathers, ye do send, every one a prince among them.
Every one a prince among them. Okay, who were the spies? The princes that were enumerated in the census. The same exact guys. The same guys that their names are listed. We're not going to even read their names because they don't need to be denigrated any more than they have because they're all dead. They're dead in the wilderness. They never got to enter. Those are the same princes. It's the same word. What did the princes report? Numbers 13, 27 through 33.
And they gave this account to Moses. We went into the land to which you sent us, and indeed it is flowing with milk and honey. Here is some of its fruit. Nevertheless, the people living in the land are strong, and the cities are large and fortified. We even saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live by the sea and along the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses, and he said, we must go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly conquer it. But the men who had gone up with him replied, we cannot go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.
Now these are the princes. Mm-hmm.
So they gave the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had spied out. The land we explored devours its inhabitants, and all the people we saw there are great in stature. We even saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak that came from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own sight, and we must have seemed like the same to them.
History always documents the Bible. Documents those who are faithful as well as those who are not. History doesn't document their triumphal entry. Instead, it documents their failure. This failure was their choice. They had all the tools, they had all the training, and they had God Almighty walking before them. Did they know God? Did they know who He was? Had they seen Him do miracles? Did He live in amongst them? Could they look upon His Shekinah glory every day? And they still didn't go. But instead of triumphal entry, we read in Numbers, it's actually 30 through 35, what happened.
Numbers 14, verses 30 through 35.
Thank you.
Surely none of you will enter the land in which I swore to settle you, except Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, son of Nun. But I will bring your children, whom you said would become plunder, unto the land you have rejected, and they will enjoy it. As for you, however, your bodies will fall in this wilderness. Your children will be the shepherds in the wilderness for 40 years, and they will suffer for your unfaithfulness until the last of your bodies lies in the wilderness. In keeping with the 40 days you spied out in the land, you shall bear your guilt 40 years, a year for each day, and you will experience my alienation. I, Jehovah, have spoken, and I will surely do these things to this entire wicked congregation which has conspired against me. They will meet their end in the wilderness, and there they will die.
Many of these men died at the age of only 60, because those that were counted in this census was 20 and upward, and they all died in 40 years. That's not a long age, particularly during that period of time. The people lived to be much older. Scripture records again this obedience and disobedience throughout our history. The people who have influence are the most documented. The people that have influence are the most documented. These princes were the ones that the people relied on for the information and to follow them. They were put in those positions of leadership for a purpose. For example, in Chronicles lists 15 times the names of the mothers of the kings of Israel. There was a good king, and his mother's name was such and such. There was a bad king, and he did much evil in the sight of the Lord, and his mother was such and such. And there was a good king, and his mother, unfortunately, nearly all of them were bad. But their moms are listed. It's important to know that parents are responsible in part for their children's actions. What you do and don't do in the rearing of your children will reflect upon their actions in the future. These princes were responsible for rejection of the land. But they didn't need to. It didn't need to be this way. It didn't need to end like it did. I worked for Albertsons as a grocery manager for a few years back in the 80s. And we had quarterly meetings at the corporate headquarters. Big deal. Joe Albertsons was still alive at the time. And they would lay out the new marketing scheme for the next quarter. And in one of those meetings we went, and I was just a clerk at the time, and our manager, they laid out the new program, and we were going to go with the Albertsons stores were very well kept, and at the time they were the second largest grocery store chain in the world, and they eventually became the largest, and then went promptly bankrupt. But they did the reason they got as big as they did because they were better than everybody else. They were past tense. And in that meeting that we had, it was the very first one I'd ever attended at the corporate headquarters, they laid out the new plan where we were going to do, instead of stocking the shelves, where we take the freight out of the boxes and put it on the shelves, we were going to do what was called cut case, where we just cut the front off the box and put it up there, you know. And that was going to save all this labor and make so much more money, and it was just going to be a wonderful thing. Well, other than looking like poo-poo and the fact that if you cut some cases the way that the boxes are loaded, you try and stick it up there, it all falls on the floor. And then during the day, you're always going to have empty boxes, and you had to have somebody policing the floor to clean up the mess because it started to look like a homeless camp and all those things, you know, that I could see happening before I ever left the meeting. But the wisdom of my project manager, Dave Pefferly, I learned from that man. I was PO'd. This is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. You know? What are these idiots doing? He said, wait. Let's give it a shot. Let's give it a try. Let's see if we can make this happen. You know, cut down on some time. We can sit in the back room and have more fun. You know, blah, blah, blah. Whatever. He set everybody's mind to accomplish the task that we'd been given. Totally changed my mindset. Went back to the office, back to the store, for all the people who were under me, and I go, let's give it a shot. And we went out there, and we cut the case, and it looked like trash, and we just kept it up, and then a couple of quarters later, they found out it was a disaster, and they changed it to something else. But nobody was disappointed. Nobody was depressed. We dutifully went and did our job, and we did it with joy. There was no reason to make it a hardship on everyone. It was fun. It was fun to try. It just didn't work. But at least we tried. So this should be a cautionary tale for all of us. The leaders could have had doubts, but all they had to do was give it a try and be obedient and do what God said. Do what Adonai said. Jehovah would have provided the victories. Probably none of them would have died. It was more dangerous to be a Levite than to go out and fight battles. They would have been exalted. The glory and the honor would have been documented for us here. But instead, it's shame. They rejected him instead of being exalted. Numbers 14, 1 through 10.
Then the whole congregation lifted up their voices and cried out, and that night the people wept. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and children will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Exactly.
Then Moses and Aaron fell face down before the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes and said to the whole congregation of Israel, the land we passed through and explored is an exceedingly good land, and if the Lord delights in us, He will bring us into the land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and he will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, for they will be like bread for us. Their protection has been removed, and the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them.
But the whole congregation threatened to stone Joshua and Caleb. Okay, the good news, people, let's kill them. Sound familiar? We're gonna Yeshua was about to be stoned for telling the truth. This parashat is mostly about people's choices. These men should have resolved to enter the land when they were chosen to lead the tribes of their fathers. They had seen Jehovah and all of his miracles, and they'd lived with him in his presence. They knew him personally, but they still rejected him. Why? Why? TJ said that it's because they were scaredy cats. I don't think so. I think they may have been some fear. We all have fear and apprehension. I think it was more along the lines of the same reason that the Pharisees rejected Yeshua. It's because they were afraid to face the people of the land? Yeah, probably. But more importantly, they were afraid of losing their status. They were somebody now. I'm a big shot. I'm a prince. If we go into the land, I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe the people will go out and start being prosperous on their own, and I won't have control over them. They lived in a community where there was no farming. Very little herdsmanship either. The livestock was long probably gone, and they were living off of manna. So the only thing they had to do, these princes, was lord over the people under their charge as they taught them Torah and taught them how to organize and taught them the art of invading this. They lived as a closed community, and they were somebody. They didn't want to lose their status. They didn't want to lose their godhood. They attempted to maintain their power and authority. They attempted to exalt themselves over the people of Jehovah. I also think it's interesting that the people, God's people, are always led. This is kind of a sidebar, so I'm sorry. We come to God. We are led by God, by Adonai, through Moses. Even today, we're led to Jehovah and his truth through the Torah, Moses. But it's Yehoshua, who actually takes us into the promised land. It was true then, and it's true today. I believe that this was all about maintaining power. Whenever we were in our Torah study a couple of weeks ago, Candy, Carly, you probably remember, I asked the question around the room, did the Pharisees, Sadducees, the religious establishment, did they believe that Jesus, Yeshua, was the Messiah? And everybody gave their answer. Mine is this, emphatically yes. They knew exactly who he was. Everything he did, every last thing, every last act, every last word he spoke was directly from the Torah and the prophets, and it was a fulfillment of the messianic prophecy. He was telling them at every step that he was who he was. And at every step, when he did exalt and proclaim who he was, the religious establishment sought to do what? They sought to kill him. And the reason that they sought to kill him is because they wanted to preserve their power, authority, and godhood. They didn't want any Messiah over them. They were it. They were the ones in charge. John 8:58-59.
And Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, "Before Abraham was, I am." So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple.
Every opportunity he was telling them, "I am the Messiah," and they knew it, and they didn't care. This is about choices. All too often, man rejects Jehovah out of fear, selfishness, pride, greed, arrogance, you name it. And that's where we kind of are today in the struggles that we face. Read the parables. Read the parables that Jesus gave. There's a parable of the sower, and he throws the seed out. Some falls on a path, and the evil one, the birds, come and eat the seed, and it goes away. Some seed falls in the stony place, and it springs up. That's the people receiving the word, and they're joyful about it. They're saved. But at the first sign, because their roots don't go deep, and they haven't invested themselves in Torah, the first sign of tribulation, the first sign of trouble, first sign of persecution, they fall away and go back to the worldly. But some falls on good ground, and it springs up and it yields fruit 10 and 100-fold. We tend to exalt ourselves over Adonai and his goodness and his love for his people. We simply don't trust him. And this lack of faith, this lack of trust, is simply sin. Just that simple. And I'm not immune to any of this. I hesitate to tell this because, again, I don't want to make this about me. But in the last 2 years, there's been a lot that's happened. One example, John and I were slapped with a sexual harassment lawsuit from a former employee who left for HR, a human resources position in another location. We'd actually hired this person back after they left to become a roadie for a country and western band. I mean, we're talking quality individuals here. The sexual harassment lawsuit, we had to get an attorney to defend ourselves through the whole thing. And our attorney said, "Don't worry, this is about money. It'll eventually come through." Sure enough, here comes the demand. "We will drop the whole thing for $25,000. So we fought instead. I would have spent the $25,000, $30,000, $50,000, whatever it took, because I am not going to succumb to extortion. TJ and I have also been sued for simply helping a couple out. It's ongoing. Who are in need? We have way more than $25,000 invested in them, and now we're also under subject a lawsuit that's in the six figures range. Recently, just within the last few weeks, had an aircraft stolen from us, and we reported it stolen. And now I have a lawsuit, or a letter from an attorney, hasn't turned into a suit yet, of a defamation, threat of a defamation lawsuit, because we defamed the person for turning it in as a stolen airplane. How many times have our server been hacked the last couple of weeks, John? Three times. Three times our server's been hacked. It's ransomware. If we want our information back, guess how much? $150,000. They don't want it back. They say they'll give it back. We really trust them. I received word over a couple days ago while I was working that because of political infighting in Washington, D.C. and other places, that three of the large projects that we've been working on are now going to likely be canceled, and we have no hope of getting paid for the work we've done. And so on. And so on. When I expressed my frustration to TJ, you are acting in fear. Ouch. She was right. I had to make a choice. Hold on to what I see, or give it up to Adonai, and persevere. I'm making my choice. I'm going to fight. And I'm going to fight until I'm dead. That's not for everybody. And I'm not trying to vilify or call anybody out. But these people had a choice to make, and they died in the wilderness when they could have lived in the land. We have a choice individually to succumb to the world around us right now or fight, to hold fast to what is true, to hold fast to what is true, to hold fast to Adonai, to believe in his word and do his word, even when it costs us. We must resolve to obey Jehovah. We need to do it now before the trials begin. Had those princes made the decision that they were going to follow him when the census was taken, when they got to the land of Israel and they went out and spied out the land, the decision would have already been ingrained in their mind that they were going to do this thing. But instead, they chose not to. Instead, they chose to preserve themselves and their authority. Everybody in here is facing trials. I could go around the room and name everyone. Candy, yours hopefully is coming to somewhat of an end. But who knows? What happens to the business is going to be up to him. The Phillipses. Anybody want to talk about what they've gone through in the last couple of months? Michael's in, and his, wow, he just was hospitalized. Rabbi's at home with his leg in the air. Hopefully he's icing his knee and doing his rehab. Revison, how many family members has she lost? Yeah, 3. All of us, every one of us have a story, right, Carly? Joe? John? Jean? Crazy. So is this it? That's what this parashat's about? Done? Actually, it's just getting started. I'm not going to keep you here that long, but it's just getting started. And this is the sketchy part, because it starts going really fast. And I need hours to develop these points. But we're going to give a little bit of a rand, of a Cliff Notes version of some of this stuff. And I think it's fun, it's interesting, it's also sobering. Numbers 1:16, hon.
Take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel, by clans, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male, head by head.
Okay. Every male, when they took the census, they took it by every male, head by head, head by head. If you go and look this up in the Hebrew, it's actually a poor translation. The Hebrew says it's le. Gu-gul-gel-lotam. Gu-gul-gal-lotam. Gul-gal-lotam. Gul-gal-lotam. Golgotha. Same word. Same exact word. Golgotha. Gul-gal-lotam. The Strong's word definition of this is a skull or head. So, A better translation of what this should say is every time that Adonai lifted up the head, the skull, lifted up their heads and counted them. Lifted up their skull and counted them. Every time I okay, so keep that in mind, because we got to come back to that. I know that this is going to be a lot to keep in your head, but keep that in mind, because every time a census was taken, there must be a ransom paid. A ransom paid. Remember the atonement message. There must be a ransom paid for each person counted. Okay? Otherwise, there's problems. Exodus 30, 11 through 14.
And the Lord said to Moses, "When you take the census of the people of Israel, then each shall give a ransom for his life to the Lord when you number them, that there be no plague among them when you number them. Each one who is numbered in the census shall give his, and shall give this, half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary. A shekel is 20 gerahs. Half a shekel is an offering to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered in the census, from 20 years old and upward, shall give the Lord's offering."
Say, for each person whose head is lifted up and counted among Jehovah's chosen, his congregation, there must be a ransom paid for each head. Got it? All right. Now, there's tons of scripture. Again, I need an hour just to develop this topic, so bear with me. The same money was the money that was used in the service of the tabernacle, the Mishkan. And later, the same money was used in the upkeep of the temple. It was called the temple tax. This same temple tax is the one that we read in the New Testament and during the Second Temple period. Matthew 17, 24 through 27.
So after they had arrived at Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and asked, "Does your teacher pay the 2 drachmas? "Yes," he answered. And when Peter entered the house, Jesus preempted him. "What do you think, Simon?" And he asked, "From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs and taxes? From their own sons or from others?" "Oh, from others," Peter answered. "Then the sons are exempt," Jesus declared. "But so that we may not offend them, go to the sea, cast a hook, take the first fish you catch. When you open its mouth, you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours."
So we are the sons of the king. If you are in Yeshua Messiah and you follow his commandments, you are the son of the king. This is part of that firstborn, the part of the heritage piece that we talked about during the atonement discussion. It's actually during Passover. Nevertheless, the ransom, the taxes, must be paid. I think we need to go back and cover this in more detail later on, because what Yeshua is saying is, you are sons of the king, and therefore, now that you're a son of the king, the taxes don't apply to you. But that's for another time. So he gets the drachmas. He gets the temple tax from what source? From a fish? Why a fish? Anybody want... It's not a trick question. He outlined something so preposterous, so absurd, that it had to be divine. There's no other way you're going to get the money. Jesus didn't go, "Hey, I'm going to go get myself a carpenter job, and we're going to make 4 drachma, and we're going to pay our temple tax and do our thing." Now, Adonai is going to pay the debt. Adonai is divinely, supernaturally going to pay the debt. And here's how. I go down and the first fish you pull out of the water, go down to the port, chuck in a hook, first fish you pour out, open its mouth, 4 drachmas. Done. Okay? It's so absurd, it's intended to be absurd. It's supposed to be supernatural. As with the temple tax, our ransom is paid supernaturally. Theirs was paid with a fish. And ours is paid by the death of our Messiah. He was killed Golgotha. It's no coincidence that he was crucified on Golgotha. Matthew 27, 33 through 35.
And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull, they offered him wine to drink, mixed with gall. But after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his garments by casting lots.
At Golgotha, Yeshua paid the ransom price for everyone whose head will be lifted up and counted as his own possession. But you have a choice to make. You have a choice to make. Did you read the last scripture I gave you?
This is from Deuteronomy 30, verse 19. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life, that you and your offspring may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, and holding fast to him. For he is your life and length of days, that you may dwell in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them.
Trust in Yehovah, and he will provide. Shabbat shalom.